Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight, hey, a very interesting show because this show will definitely have a lot of esoteric and metaphysical issues involved in it. It sounds by its title that it's not going to be such, but it really is. It's going to be describing from birth, actually before birth, that's the part that's really metaphysical, to physical death, how you can lead the most meaningful life. Now, obviously, if we're going to be talking about before someone's born, most of that is going to be involved with the parents. But it's going to be an interesting show because it's going to be in an angle and in a way that I've never actually taught this particular subject. Also, we have tonight the 2.5-hour version, and the same will be true for next week, as I just found out, which is great. After that, there will be a show that will follow us after the 22nd. And so for right now, let's be appreciative and use the time to take this relatively, we'll say, unusual subject and begin. Let me begin by explaining that when a person is going to be born, the soul is intimately involved in the process, and that includes not only the human soul, but the, we'll call it alter ego, or some people say the angelic or energy part, sub-kingdom part of the connection to the soul. That being also is involved in helping the soul who does not have the same level of consciousness, and not even close, actually, as this super being that is actually a member of the next kingdom. So the human soul is a member still, effectively, of the human kingdom, whereas this being is a member of the kingdom of liberated souls, and even among that kingdom is a whole step higher on average than the beginning members of the next kingdom as far as human beings are concerned. So that's quite a being that's helping out. It only helps when the human soul needs help. It doesn't lead. It sort of helps as is needed when the human soul both wants to be helped and also when it needs to be helped. So both of those are criteria. Now, you can say to yourself, well, what's the whole idea? Why is there this whole thing of incarnation going on? Why doesn't the soul just say, hey, I can do this job as good as anyway. I'll just put on the same senses and bodies and go down to the physical world from the second sub, the fourth sub-subplane of the second subplane of the mental plane. What an address, huh? Come here to the physical world and do its thing on its own. Why do I have to incarnate a separate being, us, and that being have all these terrible problems? And the answer is because the soul would have the same terrible problems, and souls are actually more sensitive by far than the human being is. They would probably not survive the experience. And if they did, it would so tarnish them and make the rest of their existence more difficult that the overall growth of the human races would become significantly diminished, if not even destroyed. So that plan won't work. So, you know, just so you've got that idea, you know, because people ask these questions, and they're not stupid questions. They're really good questions, but the answer is pretty straightforward. It just doesn't work because the soul is actually more sensitive than a human being, and less tolerant to the high density of energies that would bombard it within the physical world. And it's even if it could create the bodies that can handle them. Can handle the situation, the soul's operating consciousness would be diminished and it would suffer immensely. And it would be in such agony that it probably couldn't function well, if at all. And it might just lose a center in the process, and that would cause it to die almost immediately. And souls, if a soul dies, that's a whole different thing than a human being. Which, by the way, almost never happens because they stay where in a kind of cocoonish energy field that's also semi-connected to and protected by the solar angel and is actually, in some ways, part of the angel as well. It's a whole interesting interconnection. So the soul is basically begins almost isolated from almost everything. And it's only through the human contact and gradually contact with other human souls on its own sub-world that it gains any kind of interactional factors. Now, a lot of people have asked me, why is that true? And wouldn't the soul be kind of lonely in the beginning, at least, because it has virtually no contact, except with its own solar angel, for several lifetimes or more of different humans that it incarnates? And the answer is, when it is not receiving either information from its incarnate, and that information is only enlightening information. It doesn't receive any of the terrible things human beings do, because that would also cause it to lower its consciousness and it would suffer. So, you know, it would sort of be suffering by proxy. So it doesn't do that. It's actually blocked by this energy field, which is sometimes called the lotus energy, that allows it to be protected from such energy. Even when the lotus becomes opened, the lotus acts somewhat as a filtering device, not quite as solidly as it does when it's closed. And that still protects the soul from any, or most, I should say, once it's open, it's not 100%, but most of the negative energies. A small amount of negative energy can get through, but the soul has ways of dealing with that as well, so it doesn't affect its consciousness. It's a kind of a fascinating, you could say, whole other program just to deal with the life of a soul. We're not going to be dealing with that tonight, but we need to know some of that to get to the point where we understand the meaning of a human's life and how that can be improved upon, which is what we're really going to deal with tonight. If you're thinking of having children, or if you've already had them, and you want to improve that experience for yourself and, of course, the children, then this is the show to be listening to. This is going to be hands-on, operational. Believe me, even though I'm starting off with a lot of theoretical stuff, this is going to be quite a show. So here's the interesting part about this. Here is a being that comes to a planet of ours that has, within its perspective, the range of hundreds up to maybe 1,000 lifetimes of a human being, not just in the physical world, but in the astral mental as well, as its lifetime. And then, somewhere in between there, hundreds to 1,000, it eventually is freed by the human being's efforts, joining eventually with it in some of the very last lifetimes. And as it joins with the soul can release this field of energy that's been protecting it, for the most part, from negative stuff, and then it can handle all or most of the negative stuff. But in the last few lifetimes, a lot of crap is thrown at the human being to see how much the soul can handle, so that the soul can eventually be escalated or up, moved up from its place in the mental world to a place called the central or center of the Buddhic world, which is, or intuitional plane, for those of you who are more scientific. And in that realm, it doesn't need this cocooning protection, And it's also becoming closer to an equal, but not yet an equal, with the solar angel. And it's joining more with the solar angel instead of joining with the human any longer, because the human and it are one now. And so you could say the human being and the soul have become one, and they're starting to become more one with the solar angel, which is a journey going back to what is called the enlightened state of the monad, to liberate eventually the monad from the monadic plane and all to the logoic plane, or the plane of, we'll say, God, the Logos. It's a pretty big deal. So, I mean, this is a journey that obviously needs a lot more explaining to it before you would fully understand it. But it gives us pause because, as a human, we are the pawns on, if you're familiar with chess, who are doing most of the work, but eventually at the end, if we make it to the 12th rank, we can raise ourselves to become anything we want far beyond the pawn, and become something much greater. And this is kind of the principle that is designed in the progression of life. Now, what's so big about humans doing this in comparison to animals, they also advance in other things, is that humans do it through their own efforts, their own self-eventually development, and they become able to do this amazingly fully self-aware and conscious of what they're doing. Now, you could say, well, I don't know why two-way people are self-aware of and conscious of this process. Well, that's because there's so few people who are actually doing this. At the present time, there's about, give or take, 400 people on Earth doing this, and the majority of them have not reached the spiritual adulthood, which is age 28. So you start doing the math on this thing, it's a pretty small number of people. And half of the half, so it's less than 100 or so, are in a state where they won't be easily recognized because they're in the first part of this process in which all the crap is being thrown at them to see if they and the soul can handle everything being done to them with virtually no sheltering of either the lotus or the protection of the solar angel in general, even contact in some cases with this being. And so it's kind of like this is the time where you get tested and to find out whether you can renounce all of the fears, all of the pressures, all of the human-like, we'll say, anachronistic responses that you could have if you were to reach back to an earlier time, and to make sure that the soul is going to be able to deal with this kind of stuff without having to be sheltered from it by some other being. Because it's sort of like growing up and becoming an adult as a soul. As long as the soul is in the mental world, it is considered a child of sorts. Maybe an adolescent towards the very end, when spiritual development is very high and a person is in what is known as an initiatory stages. But still, not an adult. The adult has to be living in the intuitional world where it is part then of the kingdom of souls to begin with, which is the beginning of the spiritual kingdom. And then the next step is to move from the kingdom of souls to what a lot of people call the planetary kingdom or the kingdom of power, and that's different than the kingdom of all knowingness. So you become an all powerful being if you get to the point where you have reached the place where actually the solar angel is in its full consciousness. It's a pretty amazing point. But you don't become all powerful until you've gone through a lot more than even where a relatively enlightened human soul exists. Why not? Because power is the method of evil. And while the human soul is protected from, and it has almost no chance of becoming evil, it still can be destroyed by evil. And so you don't want to give something, or you don't want it to have, all power while it still can be destroyed by evil, because evil can usurp that power then and use it itself. But once you reach the point where you have attained the consciousness, making you capable of omnipotence, that's another word for all power. I was thinking of omnipotence, and I couldn't get the word that's underneath it, which is power. And once you become omnipotent, you are, it's impossible to have any power removed from you by evil, no matter what it does in the process. Oddly, just because you're all knowing, which is omniscience, in the Buddhic world, as beginning what we call masters of the ageless wisdom as of today have as their development, then you still could, just because you are omniscient, you could have power usurped from some charge you have about who knows what issue or circumstance or what kingdom you're involved with. And that could be a bad outcome. So it's a very odd thing that we think of, oh, what a masters are so great. Most of them are what is known as fifth-level initiates and a few early sixth-level initiates. But those folks are not omnipotent. They are omniscient. And so they have a different standard that they do in terms of their ability to create enlightenment and serve in various kingdoms. And they also have significant limitations because without the ability to use power, you can't directly change forms other than your own in most cases. So the result is that things can be planned and you can make, we'll say, sideways changes in things that are of form. But you can't directly change the form of something. You need to have omnipotence to do that. And you also need to have the consciousness that is associated with it so that you don't change the forms of something. As an example, I'll be very practical about this. That helps the dark side. And that can happen if you try to, if you could, exercise omnipotence and suddenly made a goofy mistake, like you said, well, I think I'll give all people three arms. Maybe a lot more ambidextrous with three arms than two. And it turns out that that leads to some very bad outcomes in terms of evil. So you can see that there is a rationale to the system that is fairly well developed. It's been millions of years, maybe billions of years in the making. Not just here on Earth, obviously, but in other worlds. Okay, so the soul, the human soul, is charged with creating incarnations, human beings. And each incarnation of a human being, the human soul strives to create the most helpful to the plan of the world as best as it understands it, which is oftentimes limited. And then the plan of the other souls that it has some consciousness with, if it's had more than a few lifetimes already under its belt. And then the wishes and explanations of its solar angel, as much as the angel will help it. Sometimes the angel does a little bit of pushing on the situation. You don't get nothing until you come up with all your own ideas here, and then I'll give you a few pointers. The reason for that is the more the soul is assisted, the less it is growing in its ability to create a new human being. The assistance has to be very narrowly created so that the soul is not being led around by the nose and also not being, in a way, dictated to. Rather, the soul does the leading and the angel just does what is necessary to pick up the little pieces that aren't right. So the soul doesn't always get it right, especially in the first 10 or 20 lifetimes, because of this this whole system of how growth is best done by the individual elements rather than the group conscious elements going beyond that of the present, we'll call it, interaction of souls together. That's very limited when you get less than 10 lifetimes for most souls. So they have almost no contact with other souls. What does that leave them? They can use any enlightening experiences of any prior lifetime, and they can then at the same time get a little bit of help from their solar angel. But they're not going to get much help from other souls probably till after those first 10 lifetimes. And it's during those first 10 lifetimes when things can go goofy, because they create sometimes humans that doesn't have the wisdom that is needed to balance the human. So you get new humans are more often than not extremely endowed in one or two or three ways in some way, but then have quirky missing elements in a lot of others. That's one of the ways I've learned that you can kind of know someone that has a relatively new soul, and that means that they are one of the first number of 10 or 20 incarnations. And those folks sometimes have wonderful, amazing skills or abilities, but then they're lacking almost equally in some other areas. And this is something that a lot of souls have to learn, unfortunately. And the feedback is when very little light comes out of that particular lifetime and a lot of negative karma is created, then the soul says, oh, it wasn't such a good idea. Maybe I got to do it a little differently. And as it grows in its consciousness, eventually it has pretty good, over time, communication with its other souls that it is occupying in the middle of the world, a whole subworld. And these souls collectively then really add to each other's benefits, because the more advanced souls, the ones that have had hundreds of lifetimes and who have had very enlightened humans, contribute as much as they can to those who have not. So there's a kind of like a desire to bring everybody up to at least a minimum standard so that they're all working together and reaching a common goal of the enlightenment of the world. Now, that works to some degree, but again, a soul that doesn't have a lot of relative consciousness may not significantly gain much value from even the most enlightened of the other souls, because he can't readily understand what that soul is trying to convey to it. Just like humans. You know, the old story, can lead a horse to water. So here is the issue. And it isn't an unwillingness, which is more or less what that phrase implies, although there's some will involved. It's really a lack of consciousness. They just don't understand enough to be able to put two and two and get four together. So now with all of that said, and I realized that that was a lot of information, again, things I haven't probably fully explained before. There's certainly parts of this in the textbook, Life and Meaning. But nonetheless, let me go deeper into, also I've written some articles about souls, which I think go into this better, but let me now get to the point that I was starting to show it, which is that the attitude of the parents prior to conceiving a child is highly important. And now, this sounds kind of weird, because I'm not talking about after the woman's pregnant. I'm talking about sometime beforehand. The best thing parents can do is to plan on having a child. Now, why would that matter? It alerts the soul. I didn't know that the souls, or the two of them, to this position, and two souls are better than one. Okay? So when you do this, if you're already connected through love, and if hopefully you're sharing some life together, this is where marriage, not in a legal sense, but in a conceptual sense, does make a difference. So and if you already have other children and you have a family, all these things play together so that the two souls of the parents help each other because they have a connection where they can communicate together better. If you just met each other that night and you're going home for a fling in the sack, that's probably not going to happen. And that is a reason not to do that, not to have children under that basis. I'm not being, I'm not being judgmental. I'm being teaching. I'm trying to explain why this is the case. And so this is not like I'm saying, oh, well, if somebody did that, they're really a bad person. No, I always say they're a person in ignorance. They don't know the stuff I'm explaining. And I'm not even saying they don't care about it. It's just that they're just unknown. You know? Who would have thought? So it really helps to get the two souls at a minimum together, particularly in younger souls, because they don't have a heck of a lot of input from anywhere. And two souls really do work better together because they balance each other. Remember, the extremism of one soul, well, that gets mitigated by even from the extremism of another soul, but they won't be the same ones. And so they play off of each other, and they say, oh, well, you want to do it this way, and I like to do it that way. We better find some medium ground here, and maybe that's good for our incarnate. Ah. By the way, this is the fascinating thing about this. If you have two infants that are born as twins, even identical twins particularly, one, they each have their own soul. And this is the weirdest thing. Very frequently, when it's two only, you have one with one soul and one with another soul. So, I mean, you're talking about separate souls connected to two different identical twins, and that means that they're not going to be identical people. I hope you get that. There was a movie called something Clone or something like that, and sure enough, that kind of principle was investigated in the storyline. I think the point here is, what if somebody has, well, eight children? I mean, you've heard of these wild, you know, births due to mostly infertile, you know, in vitro fertilization. And, yeah, okay, we could do that, too, I mean, with technology. But the thing is that they still have their own souls. And that has a peculiar kind of result. On the one end, one side, the souls do collaborate together, which is a good thing. And having more, if you have triplets or quadruplets or whatever, there's actually some benefits to each child through this multiple birth. Particularly, if they happen to be the same sex, there's even a stranger kind of event going on. But it doesn't matter. Is that same sex or they could be fraternal? But in either case, the odd aspect of this is if the birth took place at the same time, the souls can share a great deal about the incarnation. Now, sometimes the births can be a month or two apart. That's a little different entirely, because then you don't have the same collaborative thing at the beginning of the process, which is so critical. But nonetheless, this adds a whole other dimension to what we mean when we're talking about how to maximize the meaning of life, because you could have eight souls really involved, or six or five, whatever it is these days, in the collaborative side of developing these children who are going to be hopefully alive and working and well together at one time. There are so many variables under that basis, it really does. They'll get as much help from their solar angels as they could. I would be assured of that, because you think about the complexity of one person, and then two, and what if you got five or six? It's a huge, huge, we'll say, computing issue as well as wisdom issue. So it's there's a lot to deal with. And the results could be pretty remarkable. You could have some outstanding human beings come out of it, but if it's too draining and too difficult, you could have some goof-ups, too. So it's not like it's all hunky-dory, but it could be. So that's a little quirk, and I realize most people are not going to have those kinds of circumstances, but it does happen. We should think about all the unusual things that go on in this world. All right, so if the two parents have a great deal of love for each other, and at the same time, most importantly, they love the child, even before it's conceived. In other words, they want to give to the child before it's conceived the very best. Then that has the most benefit to the soul. And, well, to both of their souls in this case. And the results are pretty remarkable. Pretty remarkable. It only works between monogamous partners. Yeah, you could have polygamous partners and everybody can be whatever with everybody, but remember, only two of the people, a man and a woman, of all whatever you're dealing with, can actually conceive the child, because that's the way we're physiologically are designed. And only one sperm is going to get into the zygote. If two do, by the way, the zygote dies, so it doesn't matter anyway. But that would be rare. The whole thing is designed so it shouldn't happen that way. But anyway, so looking at this from this, because, by the way, they die because there's so many sets of chromosomes and it just doesn't work. It's like adding too much information into where it shouldn't be. Okay, so that is the ideal. And I recommend that people consider this before they conceive children. Both people have to be pretty close to the same level of consciousness for it to be really beneficial. If you have one partner with relatively low consciousness and the other one with relatively too high, that produces bad results. Worse than maybe just going out and randomly having sex with anybody. Why would that produce such bad results? You think, well, at least one partner is good. You know, the other one might be a crazy nutcase or some kind of selfish sociopath or something. What the hell? Well, the problem is that the soul of the let's say sociopath is going to be a soul who has been wounded usually through that sociopath's lifetime and maybe a few prior ones to the point where it's very deficient. Now the problem is that the other soul, which might be even an advanced soul, is going to be hurt by the collaboration with a soul of that nature. It's being forced to do it because they're basically conceiving a child, right? They know that this child will only be connected effectively to its own soul. And we need to understand that. It's only going to be connected to the soul that it is to be connected with. But these two souls are getting together and adding to the collection of the third party soul that's going to be part of the child. And in each particular case, the confusion that is brought about by this is worse than having no connection. Actually worse. So if you have a very high consciousness or very low consciousness person getting together and having children, the results can be worse than if you have two people that don't even know each other, or you have somebody going with a turkey baster and impregnating. It's the same kind of concept. It's actually worse. You'd rather not have the contact with lower consciousness soul. It isn't the soul's fault. not in a real sense. It's the product of its own development. So what you usually don't want is well-developed, highly conscious souls having children with low-developed and younger souls, because the results do not produce good things, because both of them are trying to communicate to try to produce the best outcome, but the results are negative on the eventual child soul. And that soul then gets mixed up, and the results are going to be a mess. So if you're following what I'm saying here, this is a negative result coming from the overall, confusion of human beings in wanting to have children with people who are either way ahead of them or way behind them in the realm of consciousness. I'm not talking about social economic class. I'm not talking about race. I'm not talking about anything like that. I'm talking about only the development, overall development of consciousness. I hope that makes sense to you. You can say, well, why would somebody who's, you can maybe understand why a person who's relatively lower consciousness might be attracted to and want to have sex with somebody who's higher consciousness. But why would the higher consciousness person want to have sex with? And, well, first of all, you could have a circumstance of rape or something like that. When that occurs, by the way, it's entirely possible that you're not going to be seeing that person or having much to do with him again. That the rapist person is not, their soul is not going to have input into the incarnate soul, none whatsoever. And yet the soul let's assume it's the woman, her soul is going to be on its own, but at least it won't have much input from the soul of the assuming it's a man rapist. Because if it wasn't a man, that would be a very interesting circumstance if it was reversed and we had a woman raping a man. I mean, there have been circumstances, right? Okay, so if we look at all of this from that standpoint and we put it all together, by both parents being loving, their souls communicate together and work together and eventually help the emerging incarnate through its own soul to become a better being. And each one, or just one of them, depends on the circumstances, is going to have the opportunity to communicate with the other soul better than any other soul in the middle world in many circumstances. So the souls of the parents become primary factors in the development of the incarnate. Before the child is conceived, wow. I want to let you think about that for the next couple of minutes. And, I mean, this is just the beginning of our show tonight, but you can see that this is, you know, lots of things to think about here. And it has an answer for a lot of social questions. I want you to even think about what those questions are, because they are, I mean, this really opens up a whole new area of sociology, the esoteric realm of sociology. Okay, so we'll be back in about 2.5 minutes from right now. We're back. This is Why Life Is. I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight, we're dealing with birth to physical death, and actually before birth, leading to the most meaningful of life. Wow. That's a fascinating, fascinating idea. And we've already covered at least most of the idea of planning a birth, which is planning is part of consciousness. It's the same as saying be more conscious. So if you plan a birth, you're planning so many elements of what that soul is going to end up having as its beneficial issues. It attracts to your soul a soul that meets your plan. Okay, now this is a whole other thing. Okay, so we covered the kind of the easier stuff. This is a little harder to understand. So let's take an example. Let's say you're a woman, and you say, gee, I want to have a child, and you have, obviously, or hope you do, have a man in mind of who you're going to do that with. And you get together with the man, you say, hey, listen, I love you, I want to stay together for the development of this child, I don't want to just have a baby and say bye-bye, we're going to talk about that too. And this is my plan, and then the husband, or potential father, whether you're married or not, I'm not going to get into that issue, but at least you're going to act like we traditionally think of as marriage, because you're going to stay together for the benefit of the child and your own. And each of you has a plan that you bring together and discuss, and while you're doing that, your souls are alerted to that fact, because that's a virtuous, enlightening activity. It can hear that. It can understand that. Only dark things are cut off from it. So it says, oh, they're going to have a baby. And so the soul, though I'm talking about the soul of the mother and father. I'm not talking about the soul who's going to be the soul eventually of the child. Now, what happens then? Well, the two souls actually start working on their plan of incarnation, but that plan will only be a forerunner to the eventual plan of the soul that is attracted to their plan in the middle world. And this, we'll call it the third soul, the soul of the child, the infant, the fetus even, comes and is attracted to the plans of the souls of the two parents, which is brought about by the plans of the two. So the lower is controlling it. That's another thing that's known about in esoteric teachings. And the lower being the human beings are actually controlling the process of how this moves up. It's so amazing. That's an amazing thing. Now, what is detrimental? The positive is to do exactly what I said. That produces the most meaning and the potential meaning in the life of that child. Right there. That's how you start. That's an ideal way to start. It requires commitment, spiritual and physical sacrifice. Requires a commitment to a long-term life together. And the willingness to try to tough out that life. I'm not saying everybody has to stay together, but it's really better that children be raised in a family. I hope you understand this. Not just because of the dynamics of the family after the child's born, but as much in some respects and with some people before there's ever conception. Okay? I've said this before, but I've never explained why. Now I'm explaining why. Because you could see, to explain this, it takes quite a while. Okay, so the incoming soul, we'll call it. Maybe I don't. There's no real name to this way to describe it. We could say A, B, and C, but the incoming soul that is going to be evolved intimately, obviously, in the incarnation, gets all of this enlightened, planned, high consciousness information from the souls of the two parents. It is then, especially if the souls have had an opportunity to work together, then the incoming soul has a huge advantage and being able to do the right thing. Also, the highest quality soul in comparison to the consciousness of the two souls involved is involved because it's the collective benefit of those two that produces the best effect. Wow. So now the quality of the soul is better, therefore the quality of the incarnate is going to be better. I hope you're following this, because this makes a lot more sense if you do, to why you want to live a life of that I'm describing to you. And you don't want, I'm going to give you some examples that are not beneficial. If you're a woman and you say, well, I just haven't met a guy I like, but I think I'd like to have a baby, so I'll just go ahead and get some sperm from X, Y, or Z, or however you want to do it, and I'll have a baby, and I don't need to have a man in my life. Not true. From the second you thought of it, from the second you came up with that idea, you needed to have a partner, not just a sperm. The whole process is tainted by what I would consider to be a lack of maturity and some selfishness. That's not based on any religious viewpoint. It's strictly based upon the effects on the incarnate and child.
I know there's some religious people who believe that that's a bad thing. I'm not saying it for that reason. I'm talking about only esoteric truths. Things I believe to be true. You can disagree with me, and that's okay. And you could even not like what I'm telling you, and that's also okay. And I'm sure there's people who are listening who either know or are people who have done this thing. So I will talk about how you can somewhat remedy that situation as well. But the point is that if you got the opportunity to plan this out, then do it in a way which is most beneficial to creating the highest consciousness and most meaningful life of your child, which will also reflect on yourself. If you want a great family and you want a great family life, you need to have great children. All right, so you're going to get a higher, more developed soul if you do everything I said. That soul is going to help incarnate a higher, more advanced consciousness human being. Wow, tell me, that is amazing. Now, there are exceptions to this. Human souls who are past the middle of the third initiation process in at least one of their incarnates prior may choose to have weird circumstances, in particular if they're in the fourth initiation, where they don't care what the parents are like. They even take parents that have maybe high consciousness in some respects, but they're not the greatest parents. And they'll even take an accidental birth where there's lack of planning and lack of the right circumstances, because to them the incarnate is going to be more autonomous than normal. And it may be that a family is because the incarnate is going to be so conscious, there's very few families that could even keep up with that. And so maybe it's better the family's not going to even matter to that child. Those are exceptional. Those are rare exceptions. And there are other reasons for it. The soul may feel that it's a sacrifice so that the better parents are given to each slightly lower than its incarnate's consciousness because its incarnate can deal with it. It's a strange kind of concept, isn't it? So you don't always get the best parents if you're the most conscious soul. You may choose, actually, not to. But for the most part, that's not the case. For the 99.9% of the people, what everything I'm telling you is correct. It's the way it works. All right, so obviously, going off and having children that you don't have a mate with or for right from the get-go is probably not a good choice in almost all circumstances. But it's not a bad choice. It doesn't mean you're going to be a terrible parent. It just means you're going to have more difficult challenges because the consciousness of the child maybe won't even be near your own. That's going to be difficult. So you're basically choosing a more difficult route in raising children that way. What if you don't choose to do that by making other bad choices like using drugs
alcohol is a drug, and or having strong sexual urges that you don't seem to control, you just have children. That it just happens because of your state of mind at the time, particularly if you're a woman now. This is a particularly difficult position to put yourself in because it's likely the children you have from that experience are going to have lower consciousness. But then again, people who do that sort of stuff oftentimes have lowered their consciousness if it was higher to begin with by the activities. However, there are exceptions to that. There's some people who do it once or twice and they have a child, and others that do it 100 times and they don't. So there's a lot of factors to get into this that have to be understood. Nonetheless, I strongly urge people to be more cautious about getting pregnant and having children under that basis. Now, let's talk about abortions. Oh boy, talk about a hot subject. Well, most of you know my opinion on abortion is this is going to, it makes everybody hate me. So it's equal hate. Okay, got it. That abortions before, well, give or take 18 weeks or so, do not significantly harm the soul that was attempting to incarnate. And many times the soul even knows that that is coming. But after that, it should not be done, because a lot more is involved with the development of the fetus with its soul, and it does interfere and even causes some harm to the soul. But in either case, I would prefer that people not do that, because it shows that their consciousness was in some way obviously obstructed or harmful to them to conceive, obviously not planning the birth, but not really likely planning it at all, because they didn't expect it, and that's why most people abort. There are exceptions. There's some people decide on abortion, some women decide on abortion particularly, maybe because the husband has died or become in a serious way incapacitated. There's a lot of factors that come into play. And then if there's a very bad relationship with the husband or potential mate, then that's another question. You know, should women keep children on that basis? These are questions I do not believe either I or the government or any religious group or anybody should be involved in making. I think these are questions that should be between the woman, and if there is a man involved, he also, and God, or their soul. This is something you decide for yourself about yourself. I think up to the time I said, in the 16 to 18 week period. Why do I say that? Because I don't believe we are ever going to find a way to keep children alive before that time, because there's a lack of soul connection in a couple of different ways. There's a thing called the sutratma, which is not fully connected. There's lots of things that will, and the consciousness thread is definitely not. And there's a lot of issues that would prevent our technologies from being able to circumvent that. That doesn't mean it's not possible. I'm just trying to explain that it's probably not in the near future. And for that reason, I think that we could safely establish that at this time in our development. If we ever reach a point where somehow we can get by those things, then we become soul-like in our own abilities. And then we have to talk about a whole different set of spiritual standards. So everything has to change at that point. But that could be a long time in the future. And the world would actually have to become more enlightened, not less, for that to be the case. So an abortion would probably become much less overall. So there's my thought about abortion. Take it for what you think it's worth. Now, getting back to then, you want to have children. And let's take the positive role of this. Both people are interested in doing so. They love each other. They want to raise a child together. Critical element. We'll get to that in a second. and they expect that the child will add joy in their lives, and they'll bring joy and spiritual growth and development to the child. And it'll do many other things for that child. All those things being said, then if that those are the ripe conditions for this and the best things to do before there is conception, then the results are going to be phenomenal. You're going to have more conscious children. And those children will be better in terms of integrating themselves in a family who is which is fairly high in consciousness. And particularly if you do this with every child, you'll have an amazing family. Now, this is where it gets dicey. What happens if you don't have two out of three of the kids? Guess what? You got two siblings who are great. Their consciousness is high, and maybe the third one is lacking in consciousness and has a whole series of karmic problems because the soul of that, now this is the incarnate soul, remember, is didn't get the same advantages. So now we have in the same family, a vast differences in consciousness among siblings. Now, that's not an impossible situation, but it is a consternation and a problem for everybody in the family from time to time. And it's unnecessary, provided that the advice I'm giving is adhered to. It just won't happen in most circumstances. There are karmic reasons why even what I'm saying may not bear out to be true, but almost vast amount of time it will be the way I said. All right, so here is the bottom line of this whole thing. If you really, really buy what I'm telling you, and if you're really getting to, we'll call it the esoteric psychology, the esoteric elements of metaphysics and beyond that, everything else that I teach about, this will make more sense to you than almost anything you've ever read about, from Spock to wherever, in terms of raising kids, because it starts to ring true. You could see how all the things that are misunderstood start to fall away, and you get some breath of fresh air with a lot of light to understanding just what we've covered so far. Now, this is great, because I hope tonight's show is going to be an eye-opener. It needs to be, because we've got so many elements to deal with, and we've got a long show tonight, so I figured I could just go to it. All right, so now let's talk about, so we get to the point where you have conception, and during the conception process, 9 months, give or take, it is critical that the parents stay very closely connected and continue with their plans for the birth, and if they already have a family or children, how that child is going to be integrated in with the other kids, bring them into the process, because they have souls. I want you to understand that. Even if they're little kids, they still have souls. And the souls are just as advanced. They you don't think because a child has a soul, it's the soul of a child. No. Although all human souls are considered children, but they all could be at a very advanced level. And then you bring all those souls together. So by bringing in the other members of the family, and this could include grandparents, by the way, particularly if they're living with you. So everybody can be involved, and that helps to, again, bring about the raising of the child. It helps the infant to grow. It can even help some, although not as much, in the preconception process that we just finished talking about. Generally, the children's souls and grandparents' souls are not going to be as involved and will not be able to communicate as richly as the two parent souls, because the planning, children have a limited capacity for planning the conceptual aspect and the beginning of the process, and generally grandparents aren't involved in it at all. Oh, they could be. I mean, it would take fairly open family to do that, but it could be. So the concept here is that once conception is done, then it's easier to get the souls of others that are going to be involved in the situation to get input into it. Now, why is that important? We already talked about preconception, but why is it so important while the child is growing in the woman? Well, because that's the most difficult time for the soul. It has to connect with various energy streams to the body and senses of the growing incarnate. It starts off with the mental senses, and then it develops some of the astral senses. And once it completes a certain amount of the astral senses, most of them, it has a true, real connection with the child. And that is going to take place when the child can actually, more or less, with great help, live on its own, even outside of the womb. It's not a good thing, so you don't want premature birth. But at least the soul is going to be able to keep the child alive. Without the soul, the child will not survive, no matter what you do. Okay, so, unless it's evil. That's a rare circumstance, but that's almost, we won't even get into that for, I think, right now. Okay, so in the aspect of how the system works, you want the soul to have the best connection during all the time that the child is growing in the womb, because that you'll have the healthiest child, it'll be the most well adjusted, and the best news is it'll have higher consciousness, even more so, by the process. Wow, even higher than the normal karmic issues and other things. I do believe in listening to music and showing love and affection towards the baby and all these things. But the most important thing is how the husband and wife are getting along and the other members of the family. It all plays into how that soul best is able to connect with the incarnate, which is the fetus. Yeah, really. After birth, the soul is should be fully connected with the astral body, and slightly connected with the physical body, but definitely connected with the etheric body. So we need to look at the circumstances to recognize this. The physical connection happens at the first breath of the child after it is born, physical connection. The etheric connection happens right before that takes place. So there's very little connection with the soul and the physical body until almost birth. But it's very bad to break the connection while the astral body is at least the midpoint, majority of the astral body is connected to the soul, because that gives feedback to the soul that causes it to suffer. And it results in a loss of some consciousness in the soul and being stunned. So ending a birth at that point is not a good place. That is beyond the 16 to 18 weeks, 18 weeks for sure, that I was talking about. So that's another good reason to not seek that type of answer, because it will, an abortion that later than that is going to cause a problem. Now, a lot of people will say, well, that's up for, because it's not good for a lot of time. What if the woman doesn't decide until the fourth or fifth month, you know? Well, okay, think about this. If you're not conscious enough to realize both that you're pregnant and that you don't want the child, by the 18th week that you've been pregnant, then you probably aren't conscious enough to make the decision to take that child's life. You see what I'm saying here? This is almost ipso facto, they call it. It's almost obvious right in front of you that doesn't fit very good with our understanding of consciousness. And there's going to be a severe lack of wisdom, and probably a big regret and horrible consequences. I've been through some of this, by the way. Not me personally, I wasn't pregnant, but some people I knew were. And so it's a really important thing to understand the intricacies of connection between soul and fetus and how that plays into what our decisions should be. If you are thinking about abortion, do it earlier rather than later. That's my number one thought. Earlier, better than later, and very late, don't do it at all. Okay. So if we get into the question here, then how do we find meaning for those folks that have made the bad choices? You know, I mean, were we going to take them out and publicly condemn them? You know, throw things at them or do terrible stuff? No. That the object here is to try to bring them into a higher level of lovingness, consciousness, so that they don't repeat the activity. I mean, once it's done, it's done. People should not be condemned for it. They certainly shouldn't be put in jail for it. What they need to be done with is educated, and in ways that are more metaphysical and spiritual, especially spiritual, even if it's somewhat religious, that's okay, provided it isn't taking and making a person into making a punitive gesture and demoralizing them and reducing their self-image. All that is terrible. I don't think that's an answer for anything. All right, so here's the best way for dealing with this. Use this show. There you go. Have somebody that has, maybe they had an abortion and they regret it. Or maybe they don't regret it and they're very callous about it, but they obviously are having some other problems because of that. Have them listen to the show. I mean, isn't that a good answer? I'm not trying to get more listeners. I'm trying to be of service. All right. So that would be one of the suggestions I would make, because there's so much to explain about this, and it's relatively difficult to do it. I assume most of you listening to me have heard me before, and a lot of you have read some of the things I've written, and you know something about what I'm talking about. For people who don't, some of the things I say are probably spinning your head right now, but you can go back and listen to even other shows and pick out the ideas that you don't understand from those and see where they are in those shows and listen to the explanations of that too. That's one of the advantages of how the system works with the internet, is you can just keep going deeper and deeper into the same area and find out more information. And you can also go to other people who have taught this. I'm not the only authority, right? So you can get others' ideas or others' angles of teaching, etc. All that's available. Okay. So someone who has said, well, okay, I went to 20 weeks and I decided to have an abortion. So what does that mean? Am I condemned forever because McFlower said so? No, I didn't say that. The best thing to do is to recognize that you have wounded not your soul per se, although there's possibility of that, but the soul of this other now dead fetus. How do you deal with the soul of someone else that you have caused some harm to? Well, believe it or not, you can. If you direct care and love to that soul, your soul and the soul or angel of your soul can better help that damaged, hurt soul to recover faster. I noticed how, again, I told you it's going to be like one of these shows, way out there. Yeah, it is way out there, but what I'm telling you is true. How do I know it? Oh, we won't even get into all that. But the thing is that, so you have some opportunity. In a way, it's almost like doing penance, but it's not really penance because you're directly serving and helping the very soul that you caused some problem with. Now, some people say, well, what about the fetus? That was a life. You killed it. Oh, boy. Okay, here's the point. The fetus, yes, was a life. It could have become a human life, but it most of the cases, it could not have been a human life that could have lived without either its soul, or certainly couldn't do that, but more importantly, without having been alive in the womb for a longer period of time. Because most abortions are not done after the fetus could survive on its own. You know, it just, they're not. Now, there are a lot that are done by using, you know, artificial means of keeping infants alive, but those result in all kinds of medical problems and sometimes great expense, by the way, and sometimes not a success. Okay, so the bottom line is, though, that the fetus does not significantly suffer if it still is in the womb. It actually would suffer more if you take it out of the womb and put it in the incubator for a couple of months, that's or longer. That's going to probably lead to more suffering. But in either case, it doesn't suffer as much by any standard as we would think of as an infant that has gone through the birth process. That's not, I realize, that's not an excuse for what most people say is taking life. But I don't believe, I would have trouble declaring that before, say, 18 weeks, we would be justified in saying that that is human life. The potential for human life is there. The elements of what makes a human aren't, especially the connection, all the necessary connections with the soul aren't. So, and the soul would probably withdraw, and the quote-unquote baby, if you took it out of the womb, would die. So and that's why I think it's also a misnomer to say that when someone looks at a series of cells, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, and they say, well, see, there's a little nub there. It's a kind of a hand. There's so you can even see a head sort of, and this and that. They call it a baby, or they call it a human. And neither one of those is an appropriate description. I think it's overboard. And I know that the religious groups that find in their belief structure that that's true, you know, some specific religions say that human life begins at conception. But life begins at conception. That I'll go for. Human life, I think, begins somewhere around 19 weeks or so, maybe 20. And to be as close as careful, 18 would be the outside of where I would say this. That does not mean I'm promoting abortion. I'm only trying to be accurate in how I describe what I'm saying. That's all. And for people who have the religious viewpoint that human life begins at conception, and for those people who want to live their life under that thought process, fine. It's okay. Just do so. But don't think of it in terms of putting that on to everybody else, that you can enforce their behaviors. So basically, if a woman takes a morning after pill or a morning before pill or a morning during pill or whatever it might be, to not conceive a human child, the results are, to me, not only not a sin, but not too much different than the man wearing a condom or both of them using other forms of birth control, because those cells have virtually no connection with the soul. The soul has spent its time now, don't get me wrong, in planning, if those two people were planning together, that the incarnate soul has started to plan them too. But most of the time, that isn't when women do that sort of thing, or when couples do that sort of thing. They usually don't. They usually don't plan to have a child and suddenly run after and get a morning after pill. Whoops, I made it, changed my mind. That's rare. That's not really what goes on, is it? It's usually when there's a lack of planning. It's usually when there's a desire not to be pregnant. Directly, and that would hurt the soul maybe more if you continue the birth, you continue the process. So the morning after pill is just helping the soul, not hurting it. And as far as you can, again, I don't believe there's a human being here, but some people do. The people who do, don't take the morning after pill. Fine. And I don't believe they should be forced to support other people to take it. In other words, they shouldn't be paying or have to pay for other people to take the morning after pill. They should have their conscience cleared by the fact that they don't support it, but they don't try to prevent other people from having it. They just say, hey, you want it? Go pay for it yourself. Don't do it yourself. But I'm not going to ensure you that in case you get pregnant because you didn't plan or you didn't do whatever you're going to do or whatever, that I'm going to help you do it because in my belief system, that is a human life. Okay? I completely support that. I'm doing more defining of my position on this than I ever have, although a lot of people said I put way too much about this subject in Life's Hidden Meaning, which has upset countless people. But almost everything I wrote in that book, in some way or another, there's a lot of people who found it not to their liking. What can I say? I try to write what I think to be truth, and so be it. If it's wrong, and if it's not wrong and other people still don't like it, well, that's the way it is. Someday it might be found to be truth, and then I will be a person who is very avant-garde. If not, it will be found to be totally nutty and falsehood, and I'll be found to be the nutcase who wrote that crazy stuff back when. All right, so here is to go further now. I'm trying to deal with all sides of this because I know there's so many questions people have about this. You could talk for hours just about the very beginning of this whole thing, and we've got to go through a whole life here, so I better move on. All right, so we've got now an infant born, and let's assume that the right things have been done, and you have all the family involved. If you have any siblings, they are all excited and say, oh, it's great, it's terrific, there's great love and joy, etc. What's the next thing that can be done to improve the most meaning in that person's life, the most spiritual contribution to others, the greatest level of joy and bliss and everything that new child will have? Well, the first thing is that education should start from almost the beginning of birth. I know that sounds wacko because a lot of people say, well, I don't think that infants can really absorb very much. They can, they kind of look up and they only know what's like a foot in front of them, and they only can, it's not like they have a huge amount of apparatus that are all working together at the same time. That's true. But there are basic things that infants do respond to. Music is a good thing. And some kinds of music are better than others in terms of stimulating the senses of infants. Generally speaking, the infant senses are relatively, by all standards, immature. Immature senses cannot take strong amounts of stimulation. So don't take them to a rock and roll concert when they're 6 months old or 4 months or whenever. And expect that that's going to be good for the infant. Oh, well, if you really get them in the rock and roll, I'll be a rock and roll star. No, it overwhelms the senses. As a matter of fact, you want to keep all of the input at a more minimal level than a maximum. Maximum levels of input lowers consciousness before the age of about 5 or 6. Okay, so let me say that one more time. You don't want maximal levels of input before the age of 5 or 6, and the reason for it is the senses are not well enough developed to handle it, and it causes damage to the etheric part of the sense, which is more susceptible, by the way, to damage than is the physical, which is more dense. But damage to the etheric part of the sense within weeks, months, less than a year, will cause some physical abnormalities. So if you want your kids to start losing hearing, take them to a rock concert every week. They'll be deaf by the time they're 5 years old. Not because of just the physical, but because of the electromagnetic or etheric effects on that part of their sense. You don't want to do it. I'm just giving you that as an example. There's many, many others. Visual. infants do not want extremely bright lights. Even the sun can be a problem. But they also shouldn't be in darkness all the time. And because, believe it or not, darkness, although it's a lack of stimulation of light, reduces the amount that the sense is being used to the point where the sense doesn't develop properly. So you've got to find that balance. All right. And also, on all the other senses, touch is a biggie. The touch should always be gentle and not rough and harsh. This gets tough for guys because they think, oh, he's 3 years old, let's wrestle. It's not a good thing. Maybe he's 7 years old, let's wrestle. That actually isn't that terrible. But, the senses of touch are much more sensitive at 2 or 3 or 4 than they are at 5, 6, 7, and especially 7. So you've got to look at it from age-appropriate input to the senses. That's how I'll define it that way. And that will provide higher awareness, which always leads, or is the definition, the bottom line, of how to develop greater levels of consciousness in the future. If you have low levels of awareness, consciousness will definitely be diminished. Because, again, the lower is controlling, and information coming into sense comes long before consciousness, coming from the joining together of knowledge in unique and greater ways. So it's tremendously important not to damage those senses by having unnaturally difficult levels of input. What else is the correct thing here? Any kind of physical brutality is extremely damaging. It has both an emotional component, some mental component, and a very strong physical component that's, like I said, etheric and physical. That will cause great harm. The greatest harm comes from sexual abuse. That coupled with some of the other abuses, and also if you give the same person drugs or some other thing that causes harm to the senses, can lead to a terrible outcome. Terrible outcome. How do you make sure that your children aren't having some sexual abuse issues? You look at their consciousness development, and you also watch who is having any kind of interaction with them, and how they're responding. Children, when they have any sense that is overly affected, now we're talking with sex, the reason it's so dangerous is because it affects equally the etheric and physical, while equally it's affecting the astral. They're all getting interconnected. It causes holes in the web between the two bodies, literally tears and burns them away, and then you end up with tremendous developmental problems. And it may not show for 5 or 10 years, but boy, oh boy, is it nasty. Now, in most cases, it does show to a trained person, but to a lot of other people, they may not understand what they're seeing. A slightly quiet young person who doesn't seem to be, seems excessively shy and doesn't seem to be comfortable with their own body. Look for sexual issues. It may be a friend or relative. It could be even another older child. Seldom is it children of near the same age because they don't interfere because they have enough sense to not want to interfere in the process of their own senses being disturbed. So two children of the same age, they may explore each other a little bit. There is no real sexual abuse at that point, although people believe otherwise. The sexual abuse is almost always from an older child and or near adult or adult, and the young child. That's a terrible, terrible thing. Pedophilia is one of the worst crimes because of this, because it's very difficult to do much more damage to someone than that, right? And we know this, but we don't know it because of what I'm telling you, which is more scientific and metaphysical than it is, you know, commonly understood. All right. So you want to protect your children from this. You want to protect your children from all excessive inputs into the senses because the excessive inputs lead to damage of awareness, which will lower consciousness, and consciousness is a big part of what we're doing. The next thing I want to talk about is creativity. Creativity is allowed in two ways in the development of a child. The first is by increasing consciousness and also providing opportunity for expression of the consciousness, and at the same time giving freedom to make mistakes as long as they aren't going to be fatal or seriously injuring a sense or the person as well, and within a relatively safe environment, the child needs to have freedom. So you got to have freedom to have creativity, and you got to have a realm of consciousness that allows a person to exercise their freedom so that they create something that's more enlightening. And usually examples are very important. Parents that already do this in their own life have children that do. If they don't, they have children often that don't. So this is a key element. If you're going to have children, you need to dedicate yourself to being a creative person, and creative in light, not in darkness. That's a real important, we'll say, requirement for parenting, for parenthood. When children have an enriched environment in which they are promoted to create, and done so by example from their parents, that's real critical, and others around them, including other children, including siblings and friends, you have a tremendous difference in the outcome of the eventual adult. Tremendous. I mean, it's like night and day. Now, why is that true? I mean, why can't you just love children to death but not worry about being creative yourself or having anybody else creative to them and just be overly protective and make sure they don't, so they won't have as much freedom, but you'll make sure that no harm ever comes to them. Why is that going to have a bad outcome? Well, for this reason. It's denying the person the most important element, the development of self. The self cannot be developed if it isn't creative. Yes, consciousness also is part of the self. That's why consciousness is part of the process of creation. But the first part of it is freedom. If you over-restrict children, you destroy a part of their selves. And that is a terrible outcome in adulthood. That person is afraid of everything, never feels like they ever grew up. They themselves make terrible parents and continue the process, and will resent the parents they had and be rebellious. You're going to have a whole slew of bad outcomes that absolutely don't make any sense, because you could just get rid of all that by just giving the kids freedom. Now, not absolute freedom, not like, oh, yeah, go play in the street, see if you get hit by a car. No, of course not. But can they cross a street at a certain age and you not have to hold them by the hand? Maybe, yeah, sure, probably 7, 8 years old, it's actually possible. Not much before that. Why not? Because the rest of their senses are not developed enough to judge the speed of the vehicle coming, and its distance from them, and even maybe to see it if they're excited chasing a ball or something, or even to think about where they're putting their feet and running. So you've got to look at it from all those standards. I can't give you exact ages because every child is unique in their development of sense and consciousness and creativity. But if you get those all up high, the child will live a safer life, a more durable life, a much more meaningful life, and be much more spiritually contributory because of their great enlightened creations. That I can tell. All right, what about people who argue with me, and I've had them do so even when in psychotherapy and doing counseling as well, besides psychotherapy with some people about the children. They say, I can't hold what you say. You say give X, Y, Z, more choice, and I don't even want to use a name here because somebody say, oh, he was talking about my kid. No, I know. And I can't agree with you because I've already seen that he or she just doesn't have the responsibility that normal kids have. Just the irresponsible kid is going to obviously. And I say, well, here's what you do. This is the answer, and this is my suggestion to all of you out there. You've got to still allow the freedom. I don't think you should go to the point where you just say, okay, guy on the radio said, here's the keys to the car. I know you're only 10 years old, but you should be able to drive already. Go ahead.
No,
I'm not saying that. What I am saying is that you can work your way up to that so that when they're 16 years old, you can say, here's the keys to the car, but make sure you have a driver's license and training. But at the same point, here is the bottom line. It's got to be taught. Most parents do not recognize the element of teaching because for some reason they think it's all done in some place called school. It's definitely not. School at best should be an augmentation, but not the basis of what I'm talking about. Most of this should happen within the family structure. Because nobody knows your own child like you do, or own children like you do. Going to school is a homogenization of the entire process. And believe me, it is not very good at the present time. Public schools are an abomination that should probably be just thrown out, or kept only for those people who absolutely want to go to them. But here is the point. When we are looking at how to teach a child, you teach a child just the way you would arithmetic. Let's start with addition. 1 + 1 = 2. 2 + 2 = 4. That sort of thing. You don't just say, okay, we're going to start with this particular activity, and now we'll start right in the middle of where you should understand everything. Like that's a good happy medium. And the kid breaks a leg or something. Or the next thing you know that they have hurt somebody else because they couldn't coordinate themselves right. Those kinds of problems are the egos of the parents and the ignorance of the parents coming into play in what should be a really, we'll say, self-explanatory. You start from the beginning and you work your way up. You don't say, well, my kid's going to be able to do this, so I don't have to worry about teaching them 20 other things first. That's ridiculous. That's absolutely ridiculous, and it's an expectation that's put on a kid so he'll become or she'll become afraid to be free. So, in effect, you're not making them more free, you're making them afraid to be free because they're going to fail so often. And then, worse, if a child fails, regardless of what level they start at, and they're abused in their failure by saying, oh, you're a dummy, you don't know how to do this, you can never do that, you lack coordination, self-identity. Nothing is going to be more destructive to the freedom of that child because they are not going to be creative. They're going to be both low in self-esteem, lack creativity because they'll be afraid, and resent the parents and possibly become a delinquent during the teenagers. All of these factors definitely will affect their ability to go to school and do other things and have relationships with their friends. Everything is critical during the developmental years. Before age 14, it is really important to follow these concepts as closely as possible. From 14 to 21, it's very important to allow the first 14 years to be tested. That's what teenagers do. They test a lot of these experiences they had before to see how they work for them in the rest of the world. And from 21 to 28, the parents may no longer be involved, but the child is still, quote-unquote, a child. There's still part of the adult that's still a child. It is testing out the more advanced areas, like relationships with members of either the opposite sex or if they are homosexual, in sexual relationships of whatever kind, and at the same time, having the wherewithal and the creativity to come up with new ways, not ways they've already learned, of dealing with life experiences and create something new. Usually making a lot of mistakes. Creativity at the beginning of a process almost always involves more mistakes than non-mistakes. And so 21 and 28 is not a good time to either get married. It's not a good time to probably commit yourself to a career. Sound crazy? Because our society doesn't say that, right? And it's not the greatest time to commit yourself to the, we'll say, the spiritual mission that you may be here for. It is a good time to try out a lot of different things on your own and without the restrictions that usually parents have. So I don't agree that, quote-unquote, young adults should live with their parents. I think that's a mistake. It provides a extended childhood more than it provides any protection, and it will stunt the growth of those people that do that. In the same right, it's not good for children to live out on their own, certainly if they're younger than 18, maybe even younger than 21, but it depends on the child. And almost always below about 15, 16, it's quite detrimental. However, that being said, it still happens sometimes. And the best you can do in those circumstances is, if you're in that position and you're the child or the adolescent, is to find people that can be mentors. Find substitute parents that can be of some assistance, because you're not going to be successful, most likely, dealing with issues that should be in your 20s when you're 15 years old or 16 years old. It's very, very prone to terrible outcomes. Judgment is impaired. There's all kinds of things that are not going to be as good in terms of the outcomes. So if you have children, you don't want to, in my opinion, send them away to boarding schools or military schools at those ages. If that's what you want to do, it's probably because you have aborted your own parenting position in earlier years, and now your teenagers are impossible to deal with because they are rebellious, they lack certain consciousness, or they may be overly fearful, and you think sending them away is the answer, and that may aggravate the circumstances. Why is that? Because most of those places, there are some differences in this, do not really do parenting. They do group process regimentation. Even if they're not military of nature, they are still regimentated. And regimentation leads to a stilted and non-creative person. Oh, that person might be great in some careers and some walks of life, but it is more damaging than it is helpful. As a matter of fact, I'm not too sure in my own mind that people entering the military at 17 or 18 years old is a good thing. I think it's not. There are exceptions, but for the most part, anything before 2021 to me has with it more of a handicap than a help. There's too much left undone that the person hasn't used as a skill in an emotional sense, and they will become emotionally stilted and reduced later on as an adult. During the age from 14 to 21, we are not trying to mentally develop our connections in creation. We're trying to astrally do so. And if you cut it off by going in the military at 17 or 18 years old, then that becomes a hindrance, because the emotional part of the emerging adult is shut down. Well, don't they teach them how to be emotionally coping people in the military? No. They tell them how to live. They tell them what to do and how to do and what feelings they can express and which ones they cannot. And basically, it's a repressed emotional environment. Now, what does that mean? It means that feelings are not recognized as either important or even good for people to be expressing. because they want regimentation so they get good fighters and people who can use military tactics. And it cross purposes to what the military does. That's why I would say in the best age, if you want to have a military, especially if you ever have a draft again, it be 21 years. Now, the reason it in tradition that hasn't been true is because the life expectancy of people was so much less that a lot of people didn't want to wait that long. So they would go in the military at 16 or 15, way back when, over like 150 years ago. And they would be accepted at that age because people might only live to their 45. And, of course, if they go in the military and they're in a war, they might not live much past the next year. But the bottom line in the situation is it has a negative result on the emotional development. This, in the past, has been particularly true of males because that's who mostly went in the military. Now it's going to be, it has been growing, and now it's for sure going to be men and women alike. Interestingly, and this is really going to shock you, the women will do better going in at 18 than the men will. Why is that? Because women have stronger astral natures, and they can withstand the repression more than the men can. That's just weird, isn't it? So the men think they're tough, but actually the women are tougher in terms of not being as adversely affected by the regimentation and repression that the military demands. And there's other things besides just the military this is true of. But so I'm trying to show that we have quirky ideas in our society. Take that into account in your own family and try to incorporate what I'm suggesting so you don't figure, oh, when they're 18, they're all going to go join the Army or Navy. But no. If that's what you think and they think is going to be their career choice, okay, but wait till they're 21. And from 18 to 21, have more of this experimental expression period of time of astral understanding and development. Very important. And I know that this is some, I was everything I'm saying is contrary to some viewpoints out there that, all the military families are probably saying, oh, great, now this lunatic on the radio say that our children shouldn't be going into the military until the time when everybody else is moving ahead and going to this place or that place. That's not entirely true, though. If you think about it, even the military academies, the ones that are run by the military, like West Point and Annapolis, et cetera, those academies still don't effectively put people into a true combat situation. But they do, unfortunately, cause stilting and repression. And they do have regimentation. It is not as severe as if they're actually in a more, we'll say, serious military circumstance. The worst is going into combat and being 17, 18 years old. That's really, really hard. I think that should be stopped. But, yeah, probably not going to happen. Okay. So let's go back again to the raising of children throughout the time. I kind of jumped a little bit ahead there. During the pre-adolescent period, it's best to allow children to have both time with you as a parent and other parents and definitely time alone with other children. Why is that so important? Some people say, well, they've only got one or two friends. And you can encourage more of the interactivity with other children by inviting them into your child space by creating a club or a event that they all share in. And you should talk to other parents to do this with, because the isolation of children is a very bad thing. They need to have other children because there's a thing called socialization. What does that mean? It means that they get used to the presence of others so that they, when they create, and they also learn to co-create together and they also learn to share, and they learn to be sacrificial at times, and they learn to be fair, they learn to be more open-minded, especially open-minded. And so egotism is less, selfishness in terms of astral nature is less, certain types of glamours, they're called, it's like fixed desires with them become less. It's a very good thing. Kids that are the only child in the family have a great disadvantage in this. But worse, if they're the only child and they isolate themselves, they are going to have the most propensity towards egotism and maybe arrogance. They're going to have the greatest propensity towards being selfish in their desires and not being loving and giving to others. They could become quite arrogant. So what am I describing? Arrogant people are going to be more likely children that were only children, and they didn't have any brothers or siblings, and they had little contact with other kids on any kind of interactional level. They might have gone to school, but even in school, they kept pretty much themselves. Those are the folks that are going to most likely be arrogant when they become an adult. If you don't believe me, talk to the people you think are arrogant and find out what their childhood was like and see if it bears out to be true. Okay, so let's go further with this thing. Okay, so you want to have the family structure to be open, not closed. You want to have relatives, friends, the kids on the block and all over the place to intermingle, because this adds a factor of both creation and creativity, open-mindedness, and a lack of selfishness to your children. And it's such a good thing to do. It's really good. Don't think just because they're going to school with other kids this is going to happen. It will not, unless it becomes part of their family life. Children learn what they live, not what they're taught. And going to school is regimentated again in its own way. Even if it's not a boarding school, it's still for the day and it's very regimentated. Schools that are not regimentated are hard to find. Montessori, yes, those schools are generally not regimentated. But how many schools are like that? I don't know. You can count them on what, your fingers and toes? I mean, the point is there's just not a lot of them. And even if you live where there are, you know, alternatives, where you can send your child to an interesting school that is free and you do this and that, whether it's, you pay for it or not, however your system works, does not guarantee this, because schools still have a tendency to regimentate because of the unfortunate present national and some states, generally they're more liberal, but some of the non-very conservative states, the same way, to believe that certain, quote-unquote, regimentated ways of teaching and learning are the way to go. Reading, writing, arithmetic, and pass your tests, and everybody's happy. That is crazy stuff. Crazy stuff. Remember, we're trying to grow the consciousness and the creativity of people. Knowledge is secondary. Should you learn how to read and write and be able to use basic math? For sure, but those things come not before, but after all the more important elements of freedom and creativity. Who in the heck wants someone who basically is nothing more than a walking computer as a mate or a friend or even somebody that's an office person with you or whatever, even riding a bus together? Because that isn't how we relate as human beings. We seek to have relationships based upon creativity and consciousness, and then we deal with some of the pragmatic elements of knowledge, where we make partnerships, we work together to do certain things. But the first two items are the real foundation of what human interaction is about. To eliminate that from the educational process is a crime. And our present mode in public education is exactly They don't even teach music in some places. They don't teach things like social paradigms for clubs and things. Oh, we don't have the time or money for that. We have to put it into passing tests at higher and higher levels. We've got to have little robots that are going to be able to make it through the world and be successful when they go off and make widgets or design the making of widgets. Again, a highly creative, highly conscious, somewhat knowledgeable person will be far more successful, far more meaningful life for them, far greater impact on the society than the most well-educated triple PhD, MD, every ever D person could ever be, even if they have very high intelligence. If they miss the other things, their life will be miserable, their contributions to society will be nullified by the estrangement from God, because they won't even find God, most likely. And the result will be, and they may turn into likely an atheist. And that is the outcome of that present system, and we are in the middle of it right here, and many other countries are too. We are so behind in understanding the nature of humans that we miseducate them, thinking that somehow a high test score in some way denotes meaning, when it does pretty much the opposite. Now, I'm not saying that a person can't become very knowledgeable and highly educated and be great, but I'm saying they can't do that without being highly creative and conscious at the same time. And they need to be balanced. That's the three parts of God's mind, by the way. The representations. Knowledge, third part of God's mind, in part. Consciousness, the second. And creativity, the first. Spirit with form. You might say, well, how is knowledge form? Knowledge is the beginning of the creation of form. And knowledge also does impart power. So a lot of people want knowledge because it makes them feel more powerful, because they actually are. But power used without consciousness or creativity is extremely worthless. And power used with only creation is extremely destructive, with no consciousness. Okay, so let me continue on. Let's get past now the children thing, because we've got about a little over a half hour here, and let's talk about, well, let's say, okay, I've had kids, or I'm not going to have kids at all, or whatever. Can you tell me about the rest of the story? Because we've got a lot more life to talk about than 21 years or 28 years. What goes on? Well, after you do reach around the age of 21, this is the time to be considering testing out most of the lessons, most of the consciousness and creations that you have. And the assumption should always be that there's going to be a high, we'll say, failure rate. Now, why is failure so high? Well, because if you're being creative, you're almost always pushing the limits of your senses and pushing the limits of your abilities. And it will, in many circumstances, result in some level of failure. Do not become discouraged by that, nor be discouraged by others who are trying to do that. Encourage yourself and encourage others that this is the time, the greatest time, to try this, because you have the least amount to lose and the most amount to gain. Why do you have the least amount to lose? Well, because most people have very little in terms of material issues, and other people are more accepting, in a sociological sense, of people making mistakes at this particular time in their life. So you kind of get a pass in a lot of parts of society. Further, that doesn't mean you should be sloppy or, oh, well, I get a pass, so I'll just do anything. No, you try to do your best. But in so doing, you may fail. In the failure, look not at its failure, but as an opportunity to grow both your senses and your consciousness through creating better knowledge with your personality and choosing to be more soul-like, looking for answers in a spiritual way rather than in a material way. It's hard to do. We have programmed our children and adolescents to believe that the 21 to 28 and beyond is a time when you should be getting a career and finding a way to make money in the world. Nonsense. Money is compressed time and energy. With all the money you could possibly ever have, if you don't have creativity and consciousness, you're not going to do a darn thing. So you have a lot of compressed time and energy, but no consciousness. Oh, my God, that's going to be a great combination. You're going to lose the money and time, and you're going to cause harm to others, and you're going to lack any meaning from it. Meaning comes from joining these elements together in at the same balanced way within the same person and that with others in an interactional mode. It doesn't come from making more money or from quote-unquote gaining success and recognition. These are all false premises for living. People who want titles and want the respect of others don't have it for themselves. Remember that. You can't be a spiritual person and think that you have to have a title or some kind of degree for others to hold you in esteem. That's a misnomer. Then you're putting the image before the substance. Is it okay to have an advanced degree? Sure. But I wouldn't flaunt it. And I wouldn't use it in place of who you really are. Well, I'm a PhD, so what? I'm a, anything is not appropriate. How about saying, what do you need? How can I be of service? And let me make some suggestions. That's great. Now you're on the right track. Not I am, or I want. Or you should give me. All right. So this period of time is a confusion among too many people. When I was in practice, I would see young people, what I call young people, in their 20s. They come in and, I'm not doing this or that. I failed in this area. I lost this job. I got thrown out of the house, which I think was a good thing. But, no, I'm saying that. I thought it was good for them. But all these things happen, and they are despondent and feeling like a child still. How do you resolve that? Well, you don't resolve it by going out and making more money or making a lot of money. Instead, the resolution comes from being creative and getting help in your own creation by being around others who are doing the same. Find people to be around who are exemplary in the models of the things that you're lacking and try to give to them and support them first. Don't try to mimic them or to maybe even prevent them from doing what they're doing. Become their right arm, the right hand, or just an assistant. But watch carefully their processes. Learn from it, but don't copy it. And then try to assist them more and more on a closer to, in terms of equal basis. If they permit it, that's wonderful. If they don't, they're not conscious enough to find someone else. So the process is one of us giving a helping hand to each other and you finding people who will help you in these ways. Not as a parent, maybe not even as a friend, but in some ways as a soul. This is the soul level. People between the ages of 21 and 28 are trying to find their soul. And you can say, well, wasn't their soul always there? And if they had a great, great younger time of being grown up, yes. And they won't have any problem finding their soul when they're 21. But the majority of people don't have the greatest families, don't have the best things that I've described so far in this show. And the results are they get into their 20s and they are absent their soul. And that makes them not only feel fearful and lost, they have no connection to God. These people are vulnerable to becoming atheists. These people are vulnerable to lacking the highest level of virtue. They could be virtuous on a humanitarian basis, but they aren't virtuous on a godly basis. Now, what's that mean? Virtue on a godly basis is you're creating to help others to create more, not just try to give them better comfort or food or whatever. You're helping them to become more creative beings themselves and more spiritual because you understand God and you're helping them to do the same. If you're an atheist, you're not going to do that, and that's part of the problem. Now, you might be a great humanitarian, but a poor co-creator of light. All right, so the bottom line here is that if children grow up the way I've described in this show for the last couple hours, then this whole thing is not a problem. But the majority of children don't, and it is a problem. And so for those of you who know people like this or who are listening to me now, or you can let them listen to this, right, there are answers. I'm giving you some of them. Also, if you're in this position, it very much helps to do all the things that I've written about and taught about to develop consciousness. Because as you develop consciousness, you will more naturally allow your creativity to manifest. Because creativity that is not manifested through consciousness always turns dark and selfish. And then it becomes destructive, and either you're stopped by others from doing it, or you stop it yourself but get shy of trying to do it because you think it's all going to turn into a pile of junk. So that's the issue there. What else can you do? Well, you can form alliances with people like yourself. You know, I'm sort of like AA for people who are not creative and not conscious. Well, yeah, sort of. You can actually do that. I'm not talking about group therapy now. I'm talking about life therapy. You form alliances where you do things creatively challenging for each other together, but one has one area where they're more afraid than the other was, and vice versa, and they become more solidly able to work together. This is a great idea, by the way. It's a very soul-level gesture, and it has with it many benefits. It provides a new type of extended family that our society right now doesn't condone very well, but in other cultures it's very well condoned in some places. I suggest you consider that. And you be the creator of it. You'll find others that may want to create with you. That's fine. It's a great way to manifest the better results. And you'll meet people who may become lifelong friends, maybe even a marriage partner. There's all kinds of benefits by resolving what seemed to be a problem and various failures during this time of development that can have great outcomes. Fantastic. All right, let's move now quickly to going beyond this, beyond the 28th year on average. Remember, that's no super magic number, but there is some definite science behind it. Well, when people turn 28, what happens is a very strange thing. There's an awakening to a greater need for meaning in the things they're doing. Before 28, there's a lot of experimentation, but the word meaning is not the prominent element in people's lives. It's more like experiences, excitement, thrills, hard times, failures, bumps in the road, maybe even injuries, but not so much meaning. Now, why does meaning take on the bigger part of it? Because meaning is really defined by the amount that a person is co-creating with a creator. Life becomes progressively lacking in meaning, relatively, from 28 on, if a person does not find whatever God means to them in their life. That's a terrible outcome, and there's quite a few people like that. About 20-25% of the society I live in is in that boat. And of them, half of them are atheists. So it's not a good thing to reject God, at least until you're really given it a chance to find God. Finding God is not joining a religion necessarily. It's finding that there is a meaning to life that is an intelligence beyond human intelligence that makes everything in the world connected in part. In order for things to be connected the way I'm saying, there has to be a God. Chaos doesn't produce that effect. And neither does the randomization and a fortune of forces produced by evolution. So you need to come to grips with that, read some things from all sides, including those people who have an atheistic argument, and come to your own understanding about it. You can't just believe in this. Faith is part of it, but by far it won't get you there. You've got to go a lot further than faith. You've got to have eventually a true understanding of the nature of God. And some people say, well, faith is enough for me. Why can't I do that and find meaning in life? Well, for a while it may substitute, but that while isn't going to be much more than a decade, and for many people just a few years. That's the problem with a faith-based only relationship with God. Now, you could say, well, I've had my religion, and I've had it for 30, 40 years, and yeah, but how much has your life been really meaningful if you take it to the most truthful standards? You answer that for yourself. I certainly can be wrong about this, but my experience has been almost 100% of the time. Those people who have that kind of, belief, do not develop enough meaning as their life grows, and they find there's a hollowness to their religion and to their life. That's the problem. That doesn't mean they're going to leave the religion. It's just that it doesn't contribute to the meaning of their life. Whereas you can have a religion, but this goes beyond religion. This is the true meaning of your own spiritual side. That side has to be enriched by a closer, more co-creative relationship with God. What does that mean? It means you create more of God by creating more enlightenment in others, which lends itself to enlightening yourself as well. Once your life is on that road, especially past 28, you're in the right direction. Now, there's 7 years from 28 to 35, where it is imperative that you resolve the questions and problems that inherently are involved in co-creating with God. Like, is there God at all? Is part of it. So finding God somehow is in those 7 years, for most people, is where it takes place. Does that mean that everybody suddenly has, like, a rebirthing, you know? No, it just means that the consciousness is elevating in relationship to the life of the person. And usually that is the biggest issue. Also, the spiritual side of them is developing. It isn't the fastest point of development of spirituality, though. It's just the beginning point. All right, so after that, you move into what I call the parts where you're going to do the most amount. If you actually have found a spiritual foundation and reason for living, you're going to do the most amount of contribution to the world after you have resolved it. It could be a 32, it could be a 30, a lot of people 35. And from that point forward, your life should be a highly creative one of virtue. Highly creative. It's also good not to get married to a life partner, especially if you have kids before the age of 28, for most people. Now, there's different exceptions to all these things. Some people get through this a couple of years earlier or a couple of years later. It's not a hard and fast thing, but it averages around that age. But again, our society doesn't support that. People usually get married and or have children at a much earlier age. not good, because their own development is not done, and now they're going to be trying to create new humans. Wow. That's a toughie. That's a tough problem, and whether you'll be successful at it, the odds may be against. And that's why we have problems with families. The younger families have more problems by far than those that start later and are older, with older people. You can't stop it. I'm not suggesting we legislate it or anything like that. I just think we can educate people about it, especially spiritual education, especially that. Okay, so what about the meaning in life? Well, after 35, we hear about people having life crises. Oh, they're going to have a life crisis. The life crisis, if they have it, is because they haven't found the spiritual path yet, and they become creative in a material but non-spiritual way, and their life, instead of enlightening their life and that of others, they are darkening it. That provides a hollow measure of meaning that may depict a great deal of wealth in terms of money and things, but a great deal of poverty in terms of enlightenment, God, and the relationship of you to all other souls. So your soul level could be diminished, even though your material level is quickly rising. It doesn't mean just because you're wealthy, you're going to be in poverty in terms of spirit. No. There's no reason you can't make money and still be highly spiritual, but you will use your money to help others to do the same, to become more spiritual. And so this is where the differences lie. And the meaning in your life and the joy in your life will go up as you help others to do the same. And that is the real bottom line. People that move in that direction and do so with deliberateness will find an amazing life before them. It may not be easy. And the reason it won't be easy is they may have karma to deal with. They may take on karma of others to be helpful to them. They may do things that are really tough, but because they are doing it for the goodness and the greatness of God in the world, not because they want recognition or they want power or control or they want money or all of those things, which usually do go together, by the way, in those kinds of people. Meaning as it is usurped by a material life sometimes is not recoverable. Now, I really believe in redemption and the ability for a person to make a change at any time. But the total meaning in a person's life is absolute in the sense that we only live for a relatively short time in the physical world. And once that opportunity is over, because the physical body is no longer part of us, we cannot really make up for it by going to the astral realm. Because there's things you can do here and things you need to contribute here that can't just fall over from the astral plane. And so you lose the opportunities that are so very important. The most important place to create light is in the physical world where it's so dark. The very planet we're on, if it succumbs, will be so because of this physical outcomes as they're taking place right now even. So be aware that you don't condemn yourself for the time you've lost. Always start now, because every day is a new day if you want to look at it that way. But the meaning that you have lost will be permanently lost, not to yourself only, but to the whole world. It's very hard to make up for any of it. Yes, people who become extremely enlightened quickly and do an amazing job of sacrifice, even in the last days of their life, can make up for a considerable amount of lack of meaning in the beginning. And they can die with an amazing level of satisfaction, regardless of the fact that they squandered. But they will always have some regrets, especially when they reach the monastic realm, and they have to go through their life and fix the things they did wrong. Don't do that so much in the astral world, but it's a big deal in the mental. And I'll tell you, you will save yourself a lot of consternation and grief if you don't have to deal. deal with that for the first few hundred years of your mental life, spending it virtually isolated in constant Akashic experiences where over and over again you deal with your egotism and how you did not respond in an unselfish fashion. True, you don't have the feelings anymore of selfishness, but you have the recognition of how selfish you were. And that in itself is a battering thing to your image of yourself and to your feeling of goodness in yourself. It's tough. It's a tough way to have to resolve a really nasty, we'll call it selfish, physical life. Hundreds of years of that, it's no fun at all. And it's not a cherished way to live, but it's necessary so that your next life won't be really screwed up. Now, are the things I'm saying pleasant? No, that's why I'm telling you, hey, you've got the opportunity now. And if you have screwed up for 20, 30 years or whatever it's been, make every effort to change right now. And to do all the things I'm telling you about in a few more in the next 10 minutes or so, that you can do to alter the outcome of this life. Okay, I'm 65. Let's say you're 65 years old. And you look back and you say, I've been pretty selfish. I haven't really cared about anybody. I haven't been living for anything but myself. Paid some money. Oh, I gave some gifts to people. I kind of gave to people on a personal level. I didn't do that soul-giving, you know, thing. And you look back and you say, okay, where do I go from here? Figure that you're going to live as long as you creatively produce virtue at your level of ability. That's how long you're going to live for. If you keep curtailing your level of ability, you will die earlier. So definitely you need to do non-spiritual, but we'll call it the material side of discipline, which is that you, mundane discipline, some people refer to, that you need to take care of yourself, but also all the people around you. Everything that is in some way needing some help, you need to be helpful to them as well. Be aware of that. Don't just become some kind of, well, I'm going to really help my body and get everything back in shape and ignore everybody else, because that's curtains. Want to die early? Do that and you'll see what will happen. That, particularly if you've already been selfish for most of your life. Instead, yeah, you got to take care of your body, but you take care of everybody else's and you serve everybody else's more so. And while you're getting your senses as good as you can get them at this particular age, much harm as you may have done to, you use those senses to create much greater levels of whole knowledge that then melds with your consciousness of serving everybody, so you become wiser and you gain joy from the benefits that others are doing as souls to improve their levels of being spiritual and giving. Now your life will just jump in meaning. And you might live 10 years for every one in terms of meaning. And believe it or not, if you live to like 80 years old, in those 15 years, you can suddenly make up for all the screw-ups that you had before, at least in a normality sense. I mean, I'm not going to say that you can get it all back, but you could certainly, on an average, be equal to or greater than most people. You always could have done better yourself. Therefore, you would have been more noble to have done it in the first place. But at least you achieve some level of doing the best you can now, which is the noble way at the moment. And that will make up for a lot of the issues that people have when they are moving towards the end of their life. But what if you only have 5 years you think left to live? You can make any 5 years into 15 or longer if you follow what I'm saying, but at the highest levels of it. You've got to really commit yourself, because if you have some terrible cancer and they tell you you've got maybe 2 years left to live, you won't die of that terrible cancer if you increase your consciousness at the highest levels possible and do the most service for others. I promise you. You know, that's hard to believe. Oh, it's, how is my consciousness going to change the cancer? It will. But the change in astral nature, and that the astral nature contributes to the cancers, 90% of them. So. But it's beyond that. Being more conscious means you find what's really the causes of it, and you will diminish those, if not get rid of them. But you can't do it for the purpose of curing the cancer. You can only do it for the purpose of service to others at the highest levels possible. If you concern yourself just with curing your own cancer, you'll probably die earlier. But if you do want to cure your cancers, or at least diminish their effects, so that you can truly serve others, that will work. That's not only permitted, it's encouraged. I hope you're distinguishing between the two differences of what I just said. What about people who say, well, but my senses are so bad now, I got to go from doctor to doctor and spend my life doing that? No, you don't. Again, the illnesses people mostly experience are a result of self-focus. You need a doctor to give you better knowledge about some things, but the treatment is yours. And in most cases, the treatment can be determined, as long as you have some idea what's wrong, yourself. You can look online, you can talk to a lot of people. Doctors are not necessarily very good at that. You need to be the consciousness behind who you are and what you are. We are always creating ourselves every second of our existence, not somebody else. This is a misnomer, a bad one. It is the creation principle that makes us who we are. It's how God came into existence. It created itself, and it created life so it could do the same. And human life, so it could do the same on a fully conscious level with God. And all life after human life does it more and more consciously with God. Wow. Well, if that's the case, then that's the ticket. That's the answer following that exact series of concepts to changing a life as you are older to a more meaningful one, and one that really is exemplary, even though it hasn't been great up to that point. So there's a great deal of what I will call redemption, but it isn't redemption of the lower self, it's redemption of the higher self. Creation comes in two levels. It comes at developing our lower self until we're 28 years old, and our higher self from that point forward. The higher self is our soul and our soul angel. We are becoming more them than we are personally becoming us. Personal development should slow down and cease at 28 for the average person. That isn't what happens for a lot of people, and it really screws up the meaning in their lives and messes up society and the world in general. So there are answers to those questions. Please re-listen to this section of the show if you're in this category of person. And remember that the process is always open to change and improvement. There's no point until you take your very last breath. There's no point where you can say, I'm too old, I'm too this, too that. That is pure and simple illusion and excuse and rationalization. It's none of those aspects that are true. It's just because people are too afraid and also maybe too selfish. Most of the time it's a fear thing. Oh, I really can't change. No. Sure you can change. Sure you can grow. You should definitely grow to the last day. Why not? Whoever told you that it wasn't possible? I know it's discouraged in our society by the very fact we have structure that now says you retire, you become an idiot and do these things, and you do that, and you do all the things that old people do, and that's your life. Well, that's crazy. I mean, the older you get, the wiser you get, and the more you have wisdom, the longer you live, and there's no reason you shouldn't live past, well past 100 years of age. Yes, I'm telling you that. I know some people say, well, you said you can't live past 147. You can live past it, but you're going to lose enlightenment in your body. The most amount of enlightenment you can attain is to live to 147. Because after that, the divinic energies in your bodies and the elemental have to be freed, or else they start becoming darker. Your senses become too small for you to maintain the same enlightened lifestyle, and you'll diminish. There's no reason to stay around them. So 147 is the magic age. If you could live that long and still live an enlightened life, most people don't quite make it that way because of the responsive factors. They're not responsive to their senses as much and all these other things have happened. They missed the formula that I gave you before, and by that standard, they may be lived to 105, 110, maybe 115. And someday, if we all live more spiritual lives, 120, 125 will probably be average. Not because science is going to remake our new body parts or anything, although that's not impossible to comprehend as part of the process. The real bottom line is how we live as souls while we're here will determine the need for us to stay alive and get meaning out of that life. Who wants to live to be 125 and have a non-meaningful existence? That would be hell, right? So you want it to be meaningful, and meaning really comes after age 28 till the day we die, at an average, through becoming more and more a soul. That's the bottom line. That's what you're looking for, and that's what you're looking for in others to help them do the same. If you're more focused on the others to help them do the same, you'll have a wonderful life, and the most meaning in life will be yours. I'm hoping that this is making some change in y'all, and I would love to talk more about this subject, but you know what's happening? We're running out of time. We've got one more week, though, or is it two? I mean, let's see. Maybe two more weeks. Two more weeks where we're going to get to go all of the 2.5 hours that I've spent with you tonight. And listen, I hope this has really helped. Again, we listen to the show. If you know anybody that is in a position where the meaning in life is an important issue to them, they're about to have children, any of the things that we've talked about, have them listen to the show. There are parts of it they can use as a practical way to improve their life. And until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life.